That is the pulsating beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. That means it's 8 p.m. on a Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them. Right here on KPFT-FM. I'm your guest host this evening, Eric Heen, and along with the regular team of Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, as well as Greg Audell, and our media maven, Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story. We do this by putting the spotlight on guests who take us on journeys through the windows of their souls. Well, before we get to our stories tonight, I'd like to remind you that we're in the midst of our spring fundraising drive. And we encourage you to call us at 713-JAM-KPFT, which is 713-526-5738. Or you can go to kpft.org and go to donations and be sure to scroll down to So What's Your Story as the program you designate for your support. So please consider supporting us, 713-JAM-KPFT. Feels good to contribute, makes you feel like part of the family. Well, tonight we have three very talented storytellers who are going to tell us stories about people facing desperate situations and how they battle to overcome them. Our guests are Daniel Pena, Jasmine Mendez, and Christopher Flakes. Well, let's get our stories rolling with Jasmine Mendez. Jasmine is a poet, actress, educator, and award-winning author. She's written poetry and essays for numerous publications. She's had two books of prose and poetry collections out, Island of Dreams, which has won an International Latino Book Award, and her most recent book, Night Blooming Jasmine. Jasmine's an MFA candidate in the Creative Writing Program at Pacific Lutheran University, and you can find out more about her at jasminemendez.com. Now, Jasmine, you've never been on our program before, but you have been at our KPFT studio on other programs, correct?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, and which program?
Nuestra Palabra Latino Writers Having Their Say.
Yeah, see, there's another reason to support KPFT. They showcase things like poetry, things nobody else will do. So that's a great program. Now, Jasmine, your first story, it's called One in Four. And you say it's the most terrifying story that you have ever written. Why is that?
Well, it took me about 5 years to write, because every time I kept coming to the page to write about this experience, I would break down emotionally. And I've had many health issues in my life, but this one related to a miscarriage was the most difficult, I think. Wow. Emotionally as well as physically painful.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Okay, Jasmine, the spotlight's on you. Let's hear One in Four.
One in Four. Expel. To force out or reject from the body, eject, discharge. One in four pregnancies end in a miscarriage. A miscarriage is the expulsion of a fetus from the womb before it can survive on its own. If one in four pregnancies ended in a miscarriage, why didn't I know it could happen to me? The dread of going into work sat like a heavy meal in my stomach all morning before I got up. This was unusual for me because I normally loved going into the classroom to see my students, but that morning I felt off kilter. My muscles ached a bit from exhausting myself over the weekend, and I was worried about a flare-up. My new full-time job as a drama and speech teacher was stressful. Keeping up with the house was impossible, and we had found out I was pregnant just a few weeks earlier, and the uncertainty of what 9 months of pregnancy would do to my body was overwhelming. My scleroderma didn't respond well to stress, and a flare-up would mean my chronic fatigue, muscle aches, and joint pain would come back and knock me out at any time. All I needed and wanted was some mental and physical rest. When the alarm went off, I groaned and pulled the covers tight over my body and leaned in to kiss Lupe. He moaned and stroked my shoulder. I whispered in his ear, "I gotta get up." "Okay," he said. "I need 5 more minutes." "Okay, but can you take the dog out today? I don't want to be late." "Yeah, that's fine." And he turned over to keep sleeping. I sat up and my feet dangled over the side of our king-sized bed. I breathed in and out and repeated my daily affirmation. All is well in my world. I move forward in life with comfort and ease. I used this as a reminder to myself that everything was going to be okay, even if it wasn't. I placed my bare feet on the cold tiled floor and walked to the bathroom. I started to pee. What normally felt like an exhilarating release of all the restlessness from the night before actually felt heavier and unpleasant as it left my body. What came out of me stung and burned. I wiped myself clean and saw that the toilet paper was covered in blood. Like the first time I got my first period, this was not what I expected. This was not the kind of transition or rite of passage I had ever wanted. My stomach clenched. What I had known for weeks in my heart suddenly materialized in the flesh. My baby was gone. Peeing on a stick had confirmed that I was carrying life. And now, in this urine sample, that same life was coming to an end. I stared down at the soiled toilet paper. What once was white and smooth was now covered in my self-aborted fetus's blood. A crimson-red syrup seeped between the crevices and black clotted remains of a heart that would never beat stuck to the crumpled sheets of quilted northern I held in my hand. As my heart began to harden, the paper felt soft in my hands. I didn't want to throw it away for fear of losing the only physical evidence I would ever have of having been a mother. But I did, and it floated there for a moment like a deflated raft lost at sea. The expelled fetus stared back at me, taunting. "You tossed me away, mother. How could you just toss me away?" I flushed it down and screamed for Lupe. Abnormal. Unusual, uncommon, freak, freakish, rare, isolated in a way that is undesirable or worrying. 1 in 4 pregnancies end in a miscarriage. Usually the cause of miscarriage is unknown. Miscarriage is nature's way of ending a pregnancy that is abnormal or would not make it to term. Our baby would not make it to term. What was wrong with our baby? I held on to the sink as the bathroom walls began to spin. Lupe rushed in. "What's the matter? What happened?" He stood next to me and put his hand on my shoulder. "I need to go to the ER right now." "Babe, what happened? What's going on?" "I don't know. I'm bleeding, like a lot, and I know it can't be normal." Okay, I'll take you. "Let me get dressed and we'll go. I'll bring you some clothes to change into. Just go sit in the living room." I went instead to the bedroom to grab my phone from the nightstand. I knew I would have to call into work, but I didn't even know what I would say. My hands shook, my mind a flurry of thoughts and emotions I couldn't contain. I swatted blindly for words to make sense of what I felt, but they evaded me like flies buzzing around a rotted carcass. I called the front office. "Good morning. Thank you for calling Jesuit Preparatory. This is Kimberly. How may I help you?" "Hi, Kim. It's Mrs. Mendez. I can't come in today. Can you please get me a sub?" The words shot out of me in one breath, popping like balloons with every syllable uttered. I had spoken too loudly, too frantically, too desperately for 6 a.m. "Oh," she paused. "Okay, Mrs. Mendez, is everything all right?" She had asked me the one question I needed her not to ask. Tears gushed from my eyes like water from a busted fire hydrant on a hot summer day. I can't really talk about it right now." My voice shook, my hands trembled, and I reached for the bed, only to have my legs give in to the sinkhole of emotions that suddenly overcame me. My knees hit the floor, and I began to sob. "Don't worry about it. I hope everything is okay. I'll get a sub for you. Have a good day." "Thank you." I hung up, I walked to the living room and sat down. I held my belly. I felt 1,000 tiny men kicking away at my stomach. I doubled over and rocked myself back and forth. "No, please, God, no." As a last-ditch effort, I said a silent prayer in the form of a lullaby to stifle the truth I could no longer ignore. My baby was gone. "Here," Lupe said, handing me some clothes. "Get dressed." I did, and he helped me to the door and into the car.
Wow, it's pretty powerful, Jasmine. I understand there's a little more to this story.
Yeah. So I did experience the one miscarriage, but then after many years of infertility and then finally being able to do IVF, I was able to conceive one baby girl.
Yes.
She's 11 months old. She'll be a year at the end of May.
Well, so congrats. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really powerful story.
Yeah. Tatiana, we might need to supply a tissue in here before.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I really appreciate that, Jasmine. Now, our next storyteller will be writer and poet Christopher Flakes. Christopher grew up in Mexico City, and he writes in both English and Spanish. He's been published in many publications, and he was awarded the 2017 Fabian Worsham Prize for Fiction. He has been a featured reader for Glass Mountain Magazine and Public Poetry's Library Reading Series. He edited the special prison issue for the U of H Downtown's literary magazine, The Bio Review, which focused on the writings of authors serving in prison. And Chris is currently working on his first novel. Christopher, on your webpage, you have a section called War Stories that I've seen. There you relate stories you've heard from other residents at a rehab center. Is a rehab center a good place to inspire your stories?
Yes. As it turned out, it was great material. I often say that, you know, difficult moments in life, at least if you're a writer, can be material. They can be worth something. And so a few of those stories really stuck with me, and this one in particular had a deep effect on me.
Right. Okay, let's hear that war story.
Doug is telling us a story. Around the gazebo, the other patients are nodding, expelling plumes of cigarette smoke from dry lips and reddened nostrils. We all know, because we've been in similar situations, we can all relate. Most of the time, we just did it because we had to, or we thought we had to. We were compelled by a total sense of need. We couldn't fathom that there was another, better way. So Kenny gets the money from me and walks into his room to get my dope, Doug says. And I'm left alone with his cousin, Crazy Prison Joe, and now he's taken out his gun and he has it pressed against his temple. He's kind of rubbing the barrel against the skin of his scalp as these ridiculous beads of sweat drip off his face. I've never seen a man sweat so much. And suddenly Joe just screams out, "Man, I'm such a piece of garbage. My life's worthless. I should just end it all right now." He gives out a shriek and puts his finger right on the trigger. The pain on his face is red and raw like a fresh tattoo, and I'm thinking, holy hell, what's about to happen here? I'm trying not to look at the guy, but at the same time, I can't look away. He's making these little noises like a dog whimpering, and it takes me a minute before I realize that it's him crying. I'm scared out of my wits, but I also sort of feel for the guy, so I think I should say something to him. But what do I say? Should I say, "Hey, man, life's not so bad. Now you can do all those wonderful things you dreamed of doing when you were in prison. Oh, you can fall in love. You could get a job, a car, whatever you want. Everything's possible. Sky's the limit. It's all rainbows and unicorns out here, buddy. Or at least, please wait till I've left the room before you blow your brains out." But I don't say any of that to him. I remember yelling for his cousin. I said, "Kenny, I think your cousin needs you." Kenny comes back into the room, and he's got the stuff and a little pipe and a tangled wad of Brillo in his hand, which means he wants to hang out and smoke some. I know I shouldn't do it. I know I should just take my dope and leave. But I also know I'm going to stay if he offers me that pipe. He never lets me smoke my own stuff. Kenny's a real generous guy when it comes to drugs. And if I stay around with Kenny and his fresh-from-prison lunatic cousin, that means I get a couple rocks on the house. Hell, I might get shot in the face or watch a guy commit suicide right in front of me, but if there's free dope in the deal, then I'm game, you know what I'm saying? A volley of smiles shudder across our faces. Of course we know. So anyway, Kenny just sort of glances over at Joe and says, "He's fine. He always gets like that after we smoke. He ain't gonna do nothing." Kenny asks if I want to get high, and of course I say that I do, so we smoke for a little bit, and as soon as Joe hears that rock crackling, he puts down the gun, scoots his chair over nearer to us. "When's Bridget bringing Combo by?" Joe asks, and now I'm thinking, Christ, who in the hell is Combo? What new flavor of freak is about to walk into this situation? Doug pauses his story long enough to stamp out his cigarette. He doubles over with a cough that seems to rip right through to the core of him. The years have not been kind to Doug. They haven't been kind to any of us. Maybe some of the younger addicts will be all right if they quit right now, but we all know they won't, because we didn't when we were their age. And all of us, well, we're only here because somehow or another we've been forced to, either by the courts or some faint survival kick that finally jump-started after years of inactivity. We know that we just can't keep on going the way we have been. The party's over. We know it, but we haven't really accepted it yet. Some of us never will. Well, as it turns out, Combo was Joe's dog, Doug continues as best he can, his voice still racked from coughs. One of the first things he did when he was released and back in the hood was buy a pit bull that some of the other crackheads had trained as a fighting dog. They fed the poor thing food mixed up with gunpowder and a little bit of meth. God knows what else they did to the poor thing. But Joe came along, paid them good money for it, said he was going to fight it in somebody's backyard that evening. And Kenny and him invited me to stay for the big event, and although every fiber of my being was disgusted by dog fights, I was flying so high at that point I said yes before I could even think about it. So, cut to about 5 hours later of pretty much continuous crack smoking and heavy drinking, and the backyard is full of all these thugs screaming as the two gladiator canines wage bloody hell on each other. People are pushed together in a ring around the two dogs, every last one of them bug-eyed and sweating, clutching wads of money in their fists and screaming as these two enormous beasts just tear each other to shreds. Combo won the fight, and Joe was so proud that I guess he decided not to kill himself for another day. The dog was a mess, but at least he was still breathing. The other dog looked like a wet towel as his owner carried him away, blood-stained and limp. I could still smell it. Never left me. It probably never will.
Wow. I think that shows the desperation of people caught in a trap of addiction, getting that kind of environment. They gotta crack down on them dog fights, man. I hate that. I'm a dog lover.
It is the worst.
It's incredible writing, though.
Oh, thank you. You know, I think that the dog fights is why it stuck with me, because that just seemed so horrific. And in his own weird way, it sounded like this guy cared about the dog, though it was monetary, too. You know, the dog was giving him something, but I like to believe that it was maybe giving him something more than just the money from the fights. Maybe it was some kind of, some love in an otherwise loveless life.
And they fed the dog methamphetamines and gunpowder?
Yeah.
Okay, no more dog fights, people. Okay, our next storyteller is an esteemed author who's really been making a name for himself. His name is Daniel Pena. And I know you've been incredibly busy, Daniel, so special thanks for joining us this evening.
No, it's a real honor to be here. I love this show.
And Daniel's a Pushcart Prize-winning writer and assistant professor at the English Department at the University of Houston downtown. Daniel's a graduate of Cornell University and a Fulbright Garcia Robles scholar. I guess this guy's not too bright, huh? Daniel's writing has appeared in numerous venues, including some pretty big ones like The Guardian, NBC News, Huffington Post, and his novel Bang is now out on Arte Publico Press. And Daniel, that Pushcart Award I just alluded to, that's a pretty big deal, so congratulations on that.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah.
And now we're going to have the honor of hearing the story that won that award. But before we do, Daniel, could you briefly set up the circumstances that inspired you to write Safe Home?
Yeah. So I used to be a pilot. I've always written, but before I wrote, I was a pilot. Mm-hmm. And I had been flying in this airport. It was actually north of Houston here. I won't say which one. I don't want to get the flight-based operator in trouble. But I remember landing at this specific airport. And it was interesting because, there was, when I landed at the specific airport, there was a plane that was stuck on the end of the runway. So I had to sort of veer off, you know, I get out of the plane, I approach it maybe 20, 30 minutes later. And then I find out that, it's actually, this aircraft that's too big to fly off the runway. It turns out it was a drug plane. And so it was one of those things that, it just really stuck with me.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, now I'd like to warn our listeners that this story is not for the faint-hearted. In fact, if you have kids there, you might want to tell them to go play a video game for a while. Yeah. Okay, Dan, let's hear this Pushcart Prize-winning story.
Safe Home. Cuauhtémoc always greases the landings. If the winds are strong, he lands in the desert north of Oregon on a sand strip outlined by burning tar barrels, desert oak, and split saguaro cut lengthwise to catch the neon sun. But if the winds are calm, Cuauhtémoc lumbers his aircraft, an aging M20J, onto a neighborhood street in Lomas de Poleo, just inside of Ciudad Juárez, all of the homes abandoned, everyone gone home from the drug wars. The neighborhood landing always warrants 30 degrees of flaps. The elevators pop low with a shimmy dampener extended full to the hook and bolt, no further slack to give. The flexing tension of the wire pings up and down the length of the aircraft as it ascends. You can hear it ringing like a bell in the sky from both sides of the borders. From one hill, the Mexican army looks up with silent admiration for the pilot who can grease such a landing. From the other hill, the Americans look down into the city with a fixed gaze as if willing the cartel plane to crash. Cuauhtemoc dives in at an angle, on a slipstream with his left rudder pushed full to the carpet and his ailerons turned fist over lap, so the plane falls fast and loud, the upgush of wind roaring high through the idle propellers, the plane like a vulture descending crooked into the remnants of the neighborhood. 500 feet. 400 feet. And he'll kick out the rudder to right the plane just before impact. He'll land it clean and free onto a street named Nagual, where the crumbling tar, gravel, and rocks splatter up against the nickel-plated underbelly of the plane, behind the thrust of the cooling, twin-flat 8 Lycoming piston engines still revved to 1,000 RPM. The wingtips, 48 feet from one tip to the other, scrape along the thresholds of the houses on either side of Nagual Street. The power lines roll up and stretch over the bump of the cockpit. All of the birds move to either end of the line, unimpressed at the smoking 450-horsepower engine threatening to suck them in. The driver, too, waits unimpressed in the end of the road. The driver is always the one asking questions. The driver is both Cuauhtémoc's ride home and his interrogator, his friend and his enemy. How is the flight? Any messages to be relayed? Any peculiarities along the way? Are you sure? Are you sure, he'll ask. Cuauhtémoc knows the routine, and he knows better than to incriminate himself on what he did or did not see from the skies. The driver is always different, but more or less a variation of the same man. Mid-30s, severely overweight, reeking of delicados and cheap sex and Tommy Hilfiger cologne, probably named Chewy, which is short for something Cuauhtémoc can never remember. From his cockpit, Cuauhtémoc can see the driver sitting back in his pleather-covered seats, drumming his nicotine fingers on the steering wheel of the truck. He listens to the American radio pouring in from the station on the hill. He checks his watch and waits for the engines to cut. He checks his hair in the mirror, perfectly lacquered with Tres Flores brillantine. He cracks his spearmint gum. His breath smells like Swiss cheese. His friend Lalo lies unconscious in the safe house tub, his hair tinged with sulfury smoke, a burnt diesel. His hands are smoked black and his eyes are two fiery coals peering out with a thousand-yard stare. He's barely breathing. He's soaking wet in his clothes, a blue pearl-snap shirt, a pair of Wranglers, a pair of purple Larry Mahans that have all but cracked the fiberglass tub wide open. Along the inside of the tub, there are long black arcs where the heels have scuffed in the struggle. The leather of his boots bloat about the same time his skin does. His fingers turn white and puffy in the water. Cuauhtémoc's face turns ashen at the sight of Lalo, this man he'd purged from his mind only 30 minutes ago. A million thoughts course through Cuauhtémoc's brain just then, but none louder than the questions. What happened? What's going on? Says Cuauhtémoc. He acts just as surprised as he should be, though of course he'd seen this coming from way down the pike. There's a doctor sitting on the toilet in a white coat, RMP embroidered on his lapel. Across from him, there's a boy with blue tattoos up and down his arm, these beautiful Chinese dragons with red eyes. The boy is wearing jeans rolled up to his calves, and a plastic green rosary that dips in and out of the pink water of the fiberglass tub. He seems to be holding Lalo down, or at least guarding him. The doctor checks Lalo's pulse, consults his watch, and then produces a cap needle from his breast pocket. He plunges the needle through the denim into the fleshy part of Lalo's thigh. Lalo's eyes spring open, the black of his pupils spreading like ink to chase the green of his iris away. I only fly planes, says Cuauhtémoc to the little man staring up at him. The little man rubs his eyes and says, we need to know who else. We know you were close. We need to know who. I only fly planes, says Cuauhtémoc. He says it again and again. He keeps repeating it like it might change something. Of course, Cuauhtémoc knew these things happened, but he never dreamed he'd ever be a part of it. He knows what's coming, and Lalo knows too. Everyone looks down on Lalo in the tub. The air is static. Lalo refuses to look anyone in the eye, or speak, for that matter. Some people said Lalo was queer, but others said he was just like that. Purple boots, those games he used to play. That one he used to do with a $10 bill. He'd stick it in a urinal, a cantina urinal, and then go back to the bar and drink with Cuauhtémoc and watch, observe, take note of everyone who stepped inside to take a leak. He liked to take bets with the bartender. Who'd be the one to reach in and fish it out? The thought of it amused Lalo to no end, his little giddy chuckle amplified by the half-emptied glass at his lip that made him look a little bit slow. Every so often, a patron, a nice elderly woman or a vaquero or someone, might pat Cuauhtemoc on the shoulder and say, "So nice of you to take your brother out. He looks better every day." Or, "Lucky him to have a brother like you. How is he doing as of late?" To which Cuauhtemoc would always say, "Fine, fine," and end it like that. Lalo would take little swigs and then laugh again to himself. He taught Cuauhtemoc to laugh in those days. Cuauhtemoc would laugh only when Lalo was right about who'd take the bill from the urnal. Almost always, somebody would pay the bar with a piss bill, and the bartender would know. Lalo would smell it just for proof, and the matter would be settled. If the bartender won, Lalo would cover 5% of whatever the cantina was paying the cartel that month in collections. But if Lalo was right, the bartender would pay 5% to Lalo on top of the standard fee. It was usually a wash, the odds favoring the bartender, which is why the bartender kept betting against Lalo. For Lalo, the kicks were enough, and when he won, he'd always split the earnings with Cuauhtemoc, which is how they got talking about money in the first place. This was in the beginning, when Cuauhtemoc was still new. Ever since Lalo had captured him, Cuauhtemoc had been lonesome in that briny way, sulking, scared, stone hopeless. For all of the lore he'd heard growing up in Texas about the Zetas and Sinaloa and El Golfo, with all their evil ideas and all of their evil ways, he never expected a narco to look like Lalo, who is more silly than scary, and a little bit stupid, too. Within the cartel, Lalo was an outcast, like Cuauhtemoc, and this made them brothers in a way. They both felt paralyzed by their circumstances. Their loneliness hurt and throbbed like a bruise. It was only when Cuauhtemoc thought of escape, of going home, that his body felt at ease. Cuauhtemoc could sleep when he dreamed of escape. He ate, he breathed, he laughed, knowing that everything he did, every cent he made in this line of work, would all be put to use someday, not too far from now, once the cartel imploded and he'd find his family and go back home to Harlingen. When they drank, he and Lalo mostly talked about how Cuauhtemoc planned to go back to his old farm in the orange groves and dust the crops until he bled black in the nose. He told Lalo about the June bugs and cicadas that come every so many years and the smell of that chlorpyrifos raining down from under his plain like urine. He told him of other smells, too. The smell of his mother's pozole stew boiling hot in the kitchen stove. The smell of tobacco drifting in off the breeze from the Grove Master cigarillo. Wet like rain, but sweet like autumn. Work on a farm, like a slave, Lalo would say to Cuauhtemoc. His lecture was always the same. That's your big dream? Maybe. That's the problem with Paisanos Cuau. We're still slaves, even in Texas, Tucson, wherever. We make El Norte run, and we bring this country to its knees. But at least there's some dignity to destruction, some dignity in living here. It's nice for a little while, don't you think? But eventually, I'll leave this too. We'll both leave it, you and me, before the cell implodes. That's my plan, anyway. How? He asked Lalo one time, and Lalo looked at Cuauhtemoc almost surprised, as if he hadn't expected that question, or at least the audacity of it. It was only one word, how, but between them both, it was the most dangerous word. It was the bridge between dreaming and doing. How connected them at the brain. How was the end, but also the beginning of everything. And suddenly it was out that they were both planning, scheming against El Jimmy. They would both leave their cartel, escape it, which, of course, carried its own obvious dangers. El Jimmy still knew where his mother and Uli were. It was the thing that kept Cuauhtemoc from simply taking his plane and flying off into the north. It was this fear that kept him coming back, day after day, to this desert strip or that little road in Lomas de Poleo. In the bathroom, Lalo busts his chin on his way toward the porcelain lip of the toilet. He hurls and hurls, his voice splattering echoes inside the toilet bowl that rattle out into the tile corners of the ceiling. Nothing comes up. A beaded string of spit arcs from the fleshy part of his lip to the clear water below. Cuauhtemoc hooks his arms under Lalo's and pulls him up so he's kneeling. His chin sluices bright red. It meanders and streaks like jagged lines and stops at his collarbone. He looks as fragile as an egg and just as pale. That incredible voice, that incredible noise. "Don't talk," says Cuauhtemoc. "Don't speak." He takes the Chinese food from the ledge of the bathtub and places it on the floor. "Don't eat," he tells Lalo. They look at the mirror and then look at each other inside the safe home. They see themselves, Lalo, the boy he used to be, Cuauhtémoc, the man he might become, the bloody mess, that pulp of a person. He looks at Lalo the way you might look at a car wreck, the way you might observe it in a rubberneck because you don't want it to happen to you. He observes Lalo begging. Cuauhtémoc swears when it's his time that he won't beg. Please, says Lalo, shivering in his clothes. Please, he says, reaching for the food. And Cuauhtémoc lets him have it. He nibbles at the breaded chicken. He can't keep anything down. Inside the tub, the ashy cigarette from Lalo's lips, snuffed and bloated at the filter, spins slowly under the drippy faucet. Cuauhtémoc takes off his shirt and ties it like a scarf around Lalo's neck. He pats him dry with the tail of it. He grabs him by the shoulders and blows out the votive candle. The sodium lamps pour in through the window and light up half the tub orange. In the dark, the other half is blue. Lalo's skin is yellow, his torso cut in half. The water is green, the same shade of green Cuauhtémoc remembers so well from his childhood. He eases Lalo's head into the water and closes his eyes. Lalo wraps his legs around Cuauhtémoc. And Cuauhtémoc lets his mind drift back in time, the warmness of Lalo's escaping breath, like Texas heat in the summertime. Cuauhtémoc lets his mind go elsewhere. He imagines walking barefoot in his old backyard, or what he considered his backyard at one time. It's where he played anyway, he and his little brother. It's still teeming with sounds, the tick of the heat in his ears, the tick of the insects flapping from one tree to the other, ruining everything he's ever worked for. Behind his closed eyes, there's the cicadas, too. 17-year-old cicadas, humming pitch-perfect in the shade of the orange tree branches. You can't see them, but they're there. And they'll die eventually, like all the other critters and crawlers and men and women in the grove, all poisoned by the pesticides. Lalo moans, and Cuauhtémoc brings his toes to a point. He's flexing his calves. He's bringing his body up 2 or 3 inches to the tree. He pulls down a switch and plucks a cicada from the branch. He pinches its humming legs between his fingers and dangles it away from his face, as far as his arm can reach, staring at its molting body. The cicada feels the same way it did when he was 7, the last time he handled a cicada, like a sliver of metal but undeniably alive. He remembers how he and his brother would make them fight, how he'd clip their wings and set them off against each other in a dirt ring like oversized ants. Being flightless made them hostile. They circled for a long time before they attacked one another. They made them carnivores, he and his brother. It was always a quick death. He remembers how placidly his little brother watched as one cicada would split the other open, the broken one's exoskeleton flaking like bits of fish food. And they talk over it just like teenage boys might talk over cigarettes, or old men might talk over dialysis at the Harlingen Scott and White down the road. What is the worst way someone can die? His little brother would always come up with the funny deaths. Ants, getting killed by a hooker, getting killed by ants and a fire, and a hooker at the same time. When it was Cuauhtémoc's turn, all he could think about was shriveling to death, sloughing away like that bug, molting, beautiful and iridescent, like the cicada drying in the dirt. What a slow death, he thinks. How cruel children can be. He thinks of the cicada, and thinks of the drivers, and thinks of Lalo, and thinks of himself, disposable, just like everything else. He'll molt under the hot dirt eventually, somewhere in the world. In his mind, he can see their skin sloughed off by zip ties or bullets or fire. He's suddenly conscious of his own scars all over his body. The puckered red blips of skin around his wrist from when he was kidnapped in Matamoros, the pink lacerations over his arm when he was made to fight gladiator style at midnight, the serrated bead sutures across his clavicle from when he crashed a plane for the first time with his brother. He opens his eyes and sees the face underwater, perfectly still, perfectly at peace. He imagines plucking each scar from his body to lay them over himself. He thinks he can remember what it felt like to be flawless at one time.
Some pretty powerful stuff. I saw a review on it and said it's a very difficult story to read, but one that's...
Thank you.
All right. Well, Tatiana, we are in our fundraising week or month, and do you have anybody to thank out there?
Well, let me pass it on to Dr. Hank over here. What you got?
Yeah, you know, first of all, God, can you hear me? I can't even hear myself. I'm so congested tonight. So congested. What great stories. What great stories. Listen, I know you want to go to Tatiana, but we got some great news. I wanted to thank, we know Paul Topekian, our great friend Paul. Thank you so much, Paul, again. I think he struck gold. I don't know. Sheila Stark Phillips. Thank you, Sheila. Michael Winters, Dave Fairbanks, thank you so much for your generous donations. You know, this show reminds me of something that I have to say. The variety of the kinds of programs that we've had in the last 11 years has been overwhelming. And I think these magnificent tellers tonight prove that. You know, this show started in 2008 as an open journal. We were on once a month, fourth Friday of the month. And I was told at the time by the station manager, Hank, you're a nice guy, and I know you want to do this, but no one's going to listen. That's what I was told. But obviously, we were wrong. Not only was it a great show, but we went once a week. And here we are at the heart of primetime. But I wanted to share with our listeners something that some of them may remember if they've been with us a while. March 11th, 2009, there was a woman who was on the air, and I didn't know what story she was going to tell, and I asked her. And she said, and I quote, she said, "I have a story about my 17-year-old daughter who was murdered in Detroit last year. I've never talked about it, but I wrote my feelings about it, and I want to convey these thoughts tonight." You can imagine how I felt at that moment. I didn't know what story she was going to tell, but the only thing that I thought to myself was, I don't know how long this program is going to last, but it's worth it. It is absolutely worth it. So I just wanted to applaud what Eric is doing tonight as hosting this program with these three great tellers. Every week we have tellers just like this. We need all of you to call us at 713-526-5738 because this is not corporate sponsored. We work hard, and intrinsic satisfaction is critical. But you know what? We have to have some money to make this place run. Tatiana is overpaid, I know. But beyond that, please give us a call, 713-526-5738. You know we're worth it, but we need that statement in the words of donations, please, to keep us stay alive. I apologize for the eruption, but I thought that was worth it. Now Tatiana will take over the show.
Well, let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild hosts a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset, directly across from Rice University. It's a great place to tell stories to a supportive group of like-minded people. Their next swap is May 28th. Just go to www.houstonstorytellers.org for more information. For more information, especially about joining the Guild. While you're there, click on the radio program on the menu to enjoy hundreds of shows since 2008. So you better get started. But you don't need a radio to listen to our show. You can listen to us online at www.kpft.org. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Also, if you have a program idea or a comment for anyone on our team, drop us a note at story@kpft.org and we will get back to you. We promise. And our friends at the Moss hold the Story Slam at Warehouse Live on the second Tuesday of the month. Well, most months, because this month it will be May 21st, when Mama Rules stories can range from being a mama's boy to mommy dearest. Doors open at 6:30 and it's more fun than the law allows. So yeah, H-Town is indeed storytelling town. But right now, we are hoping our listeners rule by calling us at 713-526-5738 JAM KPFT to let us know that storytelling, live storytelling, belongs in Houston.
Great job, Tatiana. Yes, let's donate to KPFT. You feel really good when you donate. You just feel like part of the family. Okay, Jasmine, let's get back to you. Your next story covers another hugely personal challenge in your life, your ongoing battle with a debilitating illness. Now, before you get to that story, could you briefly describe this illness?
Yes. So I was diagnosed with scleroderma when I was 22. And scleroderma, if you break it down, the Latin words, sclero meaning hard and derma meaning skin, so hard skin. And it's a chronic autoimmune disease that affects major organs in the body, and it produces excess collagen in these major organs. And it's very debilitating. There are treatments for it, but there is no known cause or cure. So.
Well, okay. Well, let's hear your story.
Diagnosis. Scleroderma isn't something you prevent. It's something that happens. Scleroderma has no known specific cause, origin, or cure. Scleroderma means survival, which does not always equate to living. Scleroderma is heavy joints on a rainy day that keep you from washing your hair or brushing your teeth or opening a jar. Scleroderma is diarrhea in the middle of the night that rips your insides and won't stop leaking out of you until your whole world spins. Scleroderma is cold fingers on a lukewarm day that keep you from signing a check or driving in to work on time. Scleroderma is thick skin stretched so taut you become a wax museum replica of who you used to be. Scleroderma is a 9-hour nap in the middle of the day because your body weighs more than your desire to be productive. Scleroderma is a tender touch from your lover that feels like 1,000 needles on your skin. Scleroderma is heartburn at 2 p.m. that lasts until 9 a.m. the next morning. Scleroderma is excess collagen coating your arms, shins, chest, neck, and face. Scleroderma is fibrosis in the lungs and labored breathing. Scleroderma is anxiety. Scleroderma is depression. Scleroderma is fatigue. Scleroderma is chronic. "So where did you hear of this doctor again?" asked Papi as he stared into a magazine while we waited in the exam room for the doctor to arrive. After Mommy and Papi had accompanied me to my first rheumatologist appointment, Dr. Malloy had refused to change any of my medications, despite their ineffectiveness, and would only see me every 6 months. I knew my symptoms were worsening and I needed better treatment. I had done some research and found that Houston actually had one of the top scleroderma research centers in the country. "Well," I said, "I found out about a Dr. Hayes online, but she's busy until next year, so her nurse recommended this doctor." "Okay, and what makes these doctors so good?" Always a skeptic, Papi wanted facts, charts, and graphs to prove my claims. "Well, I don't really know, Papi, but other patients say they're some of the best in the country, and this is a research facility, so they do studies here." "Oh, studies, really?" Papi had a soft spot for school, education, and the never-ending pursuit of knowledge and truth. "Can they put you in a study? Can they test us, too, and see what is causing all of this?" "Well, I don't know, Papi, but we can ask." "Good, good. That's good. I like this place." "I'm glad you approve," I said sarcastically. He glared at me above his reading glasses and returned to his magazine. My feet dangled from the exam table like a child in a high chair. "¿Cuánto se van a tardar?" asked Mommy impatiently. She gripped her purse and bit her lip. "It hasn't really been that long, Mommy. But you have to get back to work, don't you?" "Yes, but it's fine." We all knew she wasn't worried about me getting back to work on time. She was just worried about me. A few minutes later, a middle-aged yet fairly attractive dark-haired man in a white lab coat and black Gucci glasses walked into the room. "Good morning. I'm Dr. Hassan," he said cheerfully and shook Poppy's hand, then Mommy's and finally mine. "So how are you today?" He smiled and spoke directly to me now. As much as I had grown to hate those words coming from anyone lately, I couldn't help but feel like a box of warm cookies every time he smiled. "I'm okay," I said shortly, hoping there wouldn't be too much small talk. "So these are your parents, yes?" "Yes." "Good. Well then, tell me about yourself. What brings you here today?" My feet dangled. I stared at the floor. I clutched the sides of the cold plastic bed. The paper sheet beneath me rattled and sounded loud in the small room. "Well, I was diagnosed with scleroderma last November, and..." I went on to tell him my whole medical history as best as I could remember it. I stuck to the facts, and I didn't allow myself to get emotional because I needed him to know that I was strong. I needed him to know that I was ready to do whatever it took to beat this thing. I ended by saying, "And I'm here because I didn't like my other doctors, and I want to know what kind of scleroderma I have. Is it limited, diffuse, systemic, or what?" I took a deep breath and looked him straight in the eye. I would not leave without a better treatment plan.
Wow. Another touching story there, Jasmine. You know, I can't let the evening go by You know I'm going to say this without mentioning your father.
Yeah.
Now, you write about him quite a bit in your book. Mm-hmm. And, okay, I got to say, that man is a saint. So tell us what he's doing now and why he's doing it.
So my dad actually returned back to the Dominican Republic, where we're originally from, to pursue his medical degree at the age of 63, because he is interested in learning more about the body, about disease, illness, my disease specifically, to try in some way to contribute to the conversation towards a cure. So it's, yeah,
it's incredible.
It's been a journey.
63 sure. years old. He's going to medical school.
He's been there almost 4 years now. So
it's tough enough when you're 23.
Yeah. Just,
wow.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow, that's great. Good, great to have that family support. That's
for
great
sure.
to hear. Hey, Christopher, let's get back to you. Now, you're no stranger to KPFT Studios either, because you've been involved with the prison show.
Yes, that's right.
And now, have you ever heard of any other radio station broadcasting a program, anything like the prison show?
I'll tell you what, there are some now, but it is because of KPFT's The Prison Show. There is even a prison show in France now.
Wow.
So, but it all really, it began here in this very building, and such an important issue. I've been lucky enough to, you know, usually I'm sitting right here in this spot when I did come volunteer, helping with the live stream, which is something I hope to continue to do now that I'm moving back closer to Houston. Look, the Hank Lam, the show's host, and David Collingsworth, the producer, are living legends. The guys are heroes. I can tell you, as someone who's been on the other side of the bars, just how much it means to know there's people out there who care.
Right.
And the late Ray Hill, who you know is such a huge part of this legacy, has been a hero to me. He's a man who taught me that you can turn your weaknesses into strengths.
And he was a legend.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think that shows the importance of KPFT and the importance of supporting our radio station.
Absolutely.
No KPFT, no prison show.
It helped
a lot of people.
Unique programming, and it's worth every cent that someone can give. There could be no better cause.
Okay. Now, Christopher, you make no secret of the fact that you have been incarcerated.
Yes.
And a sense of being in jail may have inspired some of your stories. That's the sense I get. Now, you got another story for us. Was this inspired by being in jail?
It was, directly. This story is about a man that I formed a very unlikely friendship with when I was kind of in my rock bottom point of my life. Mm-hmm. And he's someone that affected my life quite a bit. Though we're not in touch anymore, I wish him well wherever he is and hope that he knows that he helped a guy out.
Okay, well, let's hear that story.
The story is called Silent. The sound of a real beatdown is like no other sound you will hear in your life. Unlike the movies where flying fists produce loud snaps and gunfire succession, the sound of a real fight is far duller. It is a wet sound, like the squish of meat being tenderized with a mallet, only amplified and accompanied by the dismal crack of bone and skull beneath the flesh. The most savage beating I have ever witnessed was in jail after I had caught an inmate we called Skits stealing a soup from my cellmate, Trey. The soups cost almost $1 each, and Trey hardly ever had money on his commissary. His family did what they could to help him, but with all of his court costs, they weren't able to send him much. What little he had was precious. Most of the guys in our tank shared with him, and for the most part, he ate well. Trey was a good friend to me in there, and I know if he ever saw someone stealing from me, he wouldn't stand for it. And I just happened to look up and saw Skits reaching under Trey's bunk, nabbing a beef-flavored ramen soup and shoving it into his jumper. I was infuriated. Without thinking much about what I was doing, I charged up to Skits. "Hey, what the hell, man?" I yelled, loud enough for everyone to hear. The sounds of the jail subsided, and I could feel a dozen pairs of eyes stop what they were doing to focus on us. Silent had been asleep, but I knew the commotion would wake him and bring him lumbering over. "You steal from our little homie?" he asked Skits, who at that moment was living up to his name more than ever. His eyes bulged out with cartoonish terror as he stuttered the beginnings of an excuse. He never managed to say a word. Silent didn't like excuses. When I say Silent beat the crap out of him, I don't mean it as a euphemism. Skits took the first two punches to his face and crumpled down to the floor like a broken pinata. Another volley thundered against the back of his head as he crouched, curling himself into a ball. He then evacuated his bowels audibly. It was one of the ugliest, most pathetic scenes I'd ever witnessed in my life. I've often thought back on my part in it. It was only a soup, after all, worth less than a dollar in the free world. I rationalized that I did the right thing, that I was looking out for a friend, but it doesn't feel right. The truth is it shouldn't have happened. But like almost all the violence in jail, it erupted out of banality, boredom, and pettiness. Another minor transgression punished all too brutally. But the most unbelievable thing happened after the fight, after Skits disappeared into the shower to wash himself, and most of the men returned to their card games or James Patterson paperback novels. I walked over to my bunk, which was next to Silence, and sat down. I couldn't believe my eyes. He was crying. The biggest, most frightening man I'd ever met in my life, and the tears were running down his face in great thick drops. "I hate it," he said in a weak voice. What do you hate?" I asked. "I hate how good I am at hurting people," he said to me. In a day or two, the whole episode seemed forgotten. Skits was playing shuffleboard with Silent as if nothing had ever happened. They'd drawn the scoring zones on the concrete floor with a bar of soap, and each team used plastic dominoes instead of weighted discs. At one point, Silent and Skits found themselves on the same team. They were surprisingly efficient teammates. They gave each other high fives when their dominoes slid into place. Skits smiled triumphantly, though his face was still badly swollen and bruised. We had to learn to forgive and move on, even from the most savage acts. Silent was 6 feet and 300 pounds of tattooed muscle. His arms bulged with green veins knotted around his biceps so tightly that when he flexed, I half expected them to snap like rubber bands. Most of the time his face wore a dangerous, maniacal smile. If you didn't know him well, and it is likely that none of us did, then it was hard to discern the true nature of that smile. On the one hand, he often seemed like a big, psychotic teddy bear, genuine and friendly. It was easy to drop your guard and think, well, he seems all right. Other times, the smile split his face into a deranged mask of sadistic intent. Now, if he wasn't smiling at all, that meant you better steer clear altogether. Even his most unhinged smiles were far better than no smile at all. We learned to live our lives around his mood. "You see these tattoos?" Silent said to me one morning, running his enormous fingers over the tapestry of green skulls, flaming dice, and busty women that danced across his bulging arms. "If I could burn these all away and start over, clean slate, I would endure any pain." I believed him. Many of Silent's tattoos were not just for decoration. Some of the symbols were recognizable to anyone who had done some time. They were earned through combat and loyalty. They were earned at grave cost. They were earned through suffering and the inflicting of pain. Each tattoo a throwback to a more primal time, an age when men like him ruled as kings. In a way, prison was his truest realm. There was no question he was boss in our quad. No one dared question him. And it was more than his colossal size that commanded such respect. It was more than just his physical strength developed over years of lifting weights in the rec yards of a dozen Texas prisons. It was something in the very energy he exuded. The words alpha male were tattooed on his throat just below his chin. There's no denying that's exactly what he was. But outside the concrete walls that surrounded us, the free world must have been a frightening place for Silent. So much had happened in those 15 years he'd spent inside. The world had developed at lightning speed. Out there, the kings and lords of life were small men with glowing cell phones and iridescent tablets. They ruled over vast oceans of numbers. They submerged themselves in complex programs a man like him would never understand. They interpreted secret algorithms and archaic binary languages, which spelled out the fates of millions, but which only a handful of people could ever truly comprehend. The rest of us live and die in the shadow of their workings with only a vague idea of what it all means. What place did Silent, or any of us, have in their world? His realm existed within the dank cell blocks, behind iron bars and steel doors. Within those concrete walls, he reigned supreme over a kingdom of broken men, the unquestioned chieftain of his criminal tribe. Although he yearned for his freedom as much as any of us, I could see how in many ways he was more comfortable there. It had become his natural habitat. It has been a few years since I last received a letter from Silent. He was moved to Ellis Unit, which was the location of death row before 1999. His parole was denied, and it looked like he has at least a few more years to do. In his last letter to me, he said, "Can't wait to see you again one day, buddy. Miss goofing off and talking. How's life going? How's family? You still clean? You better be. Don't ever forget this place. It's when we forget what it's like in here that we find ourselves making those old choices again. I hope I hear from you again. I will be waiting. Don't forget your boy. Be safe out there, little brother. Much love." I sent him a little money for a radio that day, the day I found his letter in my mailbox, and a few months later I heard that he was in solitary confinement, spending 23 hours out of the day in a cell of about 60 square feet with no human contact other than with guards. If he was lucky enough to have someone in a neighboring cell, they could play chess by drawing boards on their walls with soap and calling out the moves to one another. Yes, for Silent, it is precisely silence that has become his greatest enemy. Silence, stillness, and the slow crawl of time. I think of him often as I walk through the piney woods behind my house. I take nothing for granted anymore. Every step I take in any direction is a step I chose to take. I sleep at night on top of pillows, on a real mattress. I wake up every morning to the sound of my own alarm and not the shrill bleating of loudspeakers or the grinding of iron doors.
Well, sounds like jail friendships are kind of different than your normal friendships.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Okay, I got to ask you, Christopher.
Sure.
Okay, you talk about silence and skits. Did you have a jailhouse nickname?
I did. It wasn't a very good one.
You don't have to.
I'll tell you. The name, the first one was not a good name to have in prison. It was Swiss Roll, which are like these kind of little chocolate cream filled treats. Not a good name to have in jail.
Okay. We won't ask.
Yeah.
But towards the end, Silent actually awarded me the new, much harder sounding jail name of Stone, because
Stone,
he said,
yeah,
I came in soft as Charmin, but I was leaving hard as stone.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you so much for that story, Christopher.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, that does it for our stories tonight. Now, we heard some inspirational stories about people suffering from grave illnesses, people stuck in the agonizing world of addiction, and innocent people caught in the middle of drug wars. And so let's take inspiration from these stories and keep fighting to survive. And let's support each other in these efforts. And what better way to do that than by sharing our stories like our guests did with us this evening? Now, I'd like to thank you for being here, all three of you. And do you have any parting thoughts you'd like to leave our list? Any kind of gut feeling you'd like to tell the world? Christopher.
Well, all I'll say is that, I think that a lot of the stories I write, that we all write, overcoming desperation and pain in different ways. I mean, this is really the glue of humanity. It's what can connect us to people across the world that we might think are so different than us, but these are the everyday experiences that make us human.
Sure.
Yeah. I think when we talk about desperation, we're also talking about dignity, a lot of us. And for me, it's been a privilege to be on the show with you guys. I draw so much inspiration from you both.
Jasmine, quickly.
Very quickly, I would just like to say that if you have a story to tell, you should tell it, because if you don't, someone else will do it for you, and they'll probably get it wrong.
Very good. Okay, well, don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of your everyday life. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story and Treasure What You Hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.